The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I would like to tell you a Zen story. See what you think. There was a woman, a girl named Senjo, and she had a cousin. He was named Ochu. And they grew up playmates and companions when they were kind of inseparable. And when they were quite young, the father appreciated their inseparability and somehow joked that, oh, when they grew up, they would get married. Well, as they grew up, they fell in love with each other, and they thought that was the deal. They would get married. But then her father had other ideas, and she arranged for her to get married to someone else in the village. So the night before the wedding, the cousin, Ochu, he didn't want to stay. So he got on a boat to go downriver. And he was going down his boat, and then he saw that in the dark, because he was left at night, he saw this figure running along the banks of the river calling out his name. And so he went over to see, and it was Senjo chasing after him. And so she joined him, and they continued to go down the river together and found a place far down river where they got married and had children. And they lived there for 5 years. But for 5 years, Senjo kind of missed her family, missed her hometown, and asked to be taken back to see if she can ask for forgiveness from her father and somehow be reconciled. So they traveled back by boat up the river, and given the delicacy, diplomacy needed in this thing, Ocho left Senjo by the river, and he went by himself to go and talk apologetically, politely, carefully with the father. And he came to the father and he said, I want to apologize that I went off with your daughter, and we've been down the river. We have two beautiful children, and Senjo would like to come back and ask for your forgiveness. And the father said, I don't know what you're talking about. Senjo never left. The night before her wedding, she got sick, and she stopped speaking, and she hasn't left bed ever since. Come and look. So they went into the house, and sure enough, laying there in the bed was Senjo. And so this was confusing. And so Ocho said to his father-in-law, he said, come with me and I'll show you. And so they were going to take him down to the river where Senjo was waiting. But as they were walking down the road, Senjo was walking up. And as she was walking up, Senjo was coming out of bed, walking out of the house down the street also. And the two Senjos walked together, and then they merged, became one. The Zen part of the story is the question, which one was the real Senjo? The one who was sick, or the one who went downriver? What do you think? See, can you give him the mic?
It feels like they both are real.
Okay, they're both real?
Yeah, they're both real. They're both different entities that the father needed and that Ocho needed as well.
Okay, they're both real because they were needed by someone.
Also dualities, there are parts of potentials for her. She could go in either direction. And if she stayed with her father, she wouldn't be her true self. So that's why she stayed in bed and just had kind of a lifeless presence. But she was able to fulfill her kind of higher self by following and taking the risk of leaving home.
Great. Nice. Have any of you been separated from yourself? Yeah, you want to say some of the, maybe no, you don't, maybe you don't want to talk for yourself, maybe talk about someone else down the street, but what are some of the ways in which people get separated from themselves?
Do this a lot less these days, but depending on who I'm with or what the situation is, there was a time when I tried to do whatever I thought somebody else expected of me and be that person that they expected, which wasn't me.
Thank you. Some other ways in which we... Is there another mic by the stage there you can pass down?
I find that when I'm caught up in work... This way? It's not on? I find that when I'm caught up... Yeah? caught up in my worry and anxiety or just negative thought patterns, I feel separate from myself.
I'm truly awakened because I came from a very meager past, and I grew to work in a high-powered management position in a very well-known corporate America. And in doing that, it made me ill. I suffered a stroke. I had double bypass surgery. And I told Buddha, God, I'm not ready to leave yet. So give me guidance. Simply give me guidance. And he awakened my soul, my spirit, made me stronger. Guided me to this place where I'm here right now, and I just moved here a couple of weeks ago. And in walking, I was asking the same thing, give me guidance, and he led me here. And so now I feel like I'm meeting so many people that I feel a connection to spiritually. And I see, I understand why he led me here. She led me here. And I'm truly grateful.
Great, nice. So you were separated from yourself, but not anymore.
No, yes.
Great, thank you. Some other reasons why people get separated from each other, from themselves. And we can move it back down here to the...
Hello. I find the idea of self-compassion and our need to reestablish that as a way of reconnecting ourselves and tapping into the feeling of as you were a child and a child exists, and there is no, you know, judgments. And being able to go through becoming an adult and then circling back to that and finding that and reconnecting is kind of how I've personally felt a way to bring those parts back together.
How in growing up, there's a loss of connection to oneself, become separate. So I think someone behind you is asking.
Well, I get separated when I don't pay attention to a deep inner wisdom that I have. I lose sight of that. And I get lost and caught up in things and do things that probably are not the wisest and in my best interest.
Mm-hmm. When I'm not living my purpose or what I'm here to do, which it's very clear, if I isolate and stay away from my network or people who I collaborate with, then I really feel disconnected from myself.
So the question was, how do we are separate from ourselves? Sometimes, and some of the things you said were great, but they're also kind of tame. Some people are at war with themselves. Some people have really strong battle going on within themselves between that which they don't want to admit, that which they don't somehow have learned not to like, that which they want to deny. Doesn't that also happen? Yes, that's very true.
A long time ago, I was in a really bad marriage, and I would spend a few minutes every day realizing, I hate this. I don't like this. There is no space for me in this life. But I could only face that for a few minutes a day, and then I would go back to whatever I had to do to get through the rest of the day. And it took several years to be able to hold that realization for long enough that I could do something about it.
And what was, so you were frightened by the realization, or?
I think, yeah, I was horrified.
So you pulled away?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
I think one way of separating is waking up.
Is what?
Waking up.
Waking up. One way of separating is waking up. Explain a little bit.
I think sometimes it takes a big event in our life to make us realize our place in this world. And sometimes we just walk the path and do the practice. And slowly we come to recognize the separation.
From ourselves, or?
Yeah.
So waking up, we realize we have been separated, or we see the separation. Is that
correct? It's the contrast.
No? Yes, that's true. Sometimes it takes a long time before someone sees how disconnected they are, how separate, or how much they're at war with themselves, or holding something off at bay, or... There are some people who use Buddhist practice and meditation actually as a way of distancing themselves from what they think is painful, what is unacceptable, who they're not supposed to be. It's kind of painful to see when it's like that. And some people, I've known people who've heroically done Buddhist meditation practice so they could stay separate, so they wouldn't have to admit or wouldn't have to look at something, be here. So which one is the real Senjo? So it's a kind of a Zen koan. So, you know, when I practice koans with the Zen teachers, generally if you try to come with a logical answer, you got thrown out of the room. And you have to, maybe the next day you can go back and try again, and you try a few hundred times. And sometimes, several times in a day, we'd get the chance to go with our the Zen question and present it, and then the Zen master would have a little bell and go, that meant, you know, see you later. That answer didn't work. So at that risk of that, the way the question is traditionally posed is, which one of the two is the real Senjo? But I think neither one are the real Senjo, but rather because they're separated from each other, and it's the coming together which makes it somehow real. Each is partial, each is disconnected to the other part. And I see this, especially as a teacher on retreats, how many people are struggling against themselves, how many people live their life in such a way that they're at war with themselves, or struggling against something, or pretending something's not there, or trying to hold something at bay, or, you know, keep it down so it doesn't show itself. And generally, if you do mindfulness meditation, especially if you do it somewhat, deeply or intensely, like on retreat, it's not sustainable. The cost and the exhaustion of doing that becomes pretty evident. And then slowly, people begin to settle and relax and deepen, and sometimes at the expense of having to face what's really painful or what's really frightening. And people associate nowadays in kind of secular mindfulness, this kind of clinical mindfulness movement. I think for many people, the association with mindfulness is that it's kind of clinically safe. That it's, you know, that it's, you know, good for your health, and that, you know, it's stress reducing, and a lot of people are stressed out, you can maybe sleep better. But that's true in many ways. But Buddhist meditation was done more deeply for deeper purposes. Sometimes it's not, you know, so pleasant automatically, not because it's the meditation's fault. But because we've been holding ourselves separate, we've been holding something at bay, we're pretending, we're avoiding something that is difficult. And part of the advantage of this kind of practice, and part of the purpose, among other things, is to be able to meet the parts of ourselves that we're holding at bay, that we hold distance, and that's a whole range of things. Sometimes it's the difficult things, frightening things, and I've known people who sat and did, it's peaceful, stress-reducing. You read the New York Times, and stress-reducing, and good for your blood and everything. And I've known people who've broken out in a sweat sitting doing this mindfully because of what they had to face. And I've known people who have slowly opened up to some aspect of themselves, and rather than being difficult, it was some of the most beautiful parts of themselves that they disowned, that they were afraid of. Some of the most inspiring parts of what made their heart sing, and the sense of purpose in life that they never dared admit to themselves, or never felt courageous enough to follow. And so this idea of sitting quietly and being mindful, being alert to what's here, and let what's here show itself to us, over time we'll start seeing or feeling how we're separate, how we're holding things at bay, how we're shut down, how we're resisting. And rather than seeing those as a mistake or a problem, for some people that's the beginning of the healing. That's the beginning of the path to open up. And so it's important not to associate this practice only with stress reduction, only with bliss, and, you know, if you just can go and meditate a lot, you'll float on the clouds and have lots of friends, or something nice, win lottery tickets. But you know, I think it's this is meant to mature us in real ways, so we become real, and that path of becoming real, of becoming connected, of of reassembling all the pieces of ourselves, for some people is an arduous task. There's so many disconnections, so many separations. There's so much to reclaim and bring together. So classically, in Buddhism, the practice of mindfulness is done together with the practice of concentration. And the word and the concentration practice is explicitly understood as the unification, as a unification practice. And the idea of becoming unified is from the ancient times as part of the purpose of Buddhist practice, to bring all the different pieces, the disparate parts of ourselves, and bring them together so they can all be in the same room, in the same heart, held together. And it requires being willing to be present for that which is good, bad, and ugly. You know, I don't know why the bad has two-thirds of that of that saying. Maybe it's just a coincidence. It just sounds nice. So it comes off the tongue. But maybe it's the good, bad, ugly, and everything else. But the you know, to be willing to kind of sit and kind of be present for the whole shebang, everything. And that takes a lot of courage, because many people are not coming to meditation to feel unpleasant. They're coming to be pleasant, to have a nicer time. Yes, that's be good. But you know, sometimes in order to grow up, in order to heal, in order to bring together what is the whole thing to a whole, a unified whole, a harmonious whole, we have this, the re-owning or reconnecting, or, you know, it can be quite difficult and take a long time. I was struck in the story of Senjo of the role of the parent, the father, the parent's choices, the parent's ideas of what the child was supposed to do, and the impact that had on the child. She got disconnected from herself. She had one thing she wanted to do that was kind of her, kind of more, much more maybe her, what made her heart sing and her sense of purpose. She thought she had this purpose to get married with this guy. But then there was a father's voice, a father's expectation of what's supposed to become of her life. And if some people live under that struggle of parental expectations and what they want to do, and it can make a real divide. Sometimes people give up parts of themselves to live for their parents. Sometimes they decide the opposite, but then there's a rupture with the family. And it's also a rupture inside of oneself as well. It's difficult. So then how do we come together and hold that? And how do we breathe with it? And how do we form a kind of unification? So to bring together that which is held apart is one way of understanding the purpose of meditation. So what are you holding apart? What are you not willing to look at? What are you avoiding? There's a story of a Buddhist hermit who lived deep in the mountains. And the story goes that if you went to spend 3 days hiking into where he was, that he would have the perfect advice for you, just what you needed to know. And he would assess you and see you. And so people would hike for days, 3 days, and go all the way in. And he didn't say much, but you'd come there and you'd tell your story. He'd listen, maybe for hours, you'd tell your story. And he was a great listener. It felt so good to be listened to. Some felt understood. And then he would be silent for a long time. And then he would whisper in your ear his advice. And everyone, when they heard his advice, that, really? I walked 3 days this far? And then they'd hike out 3 days. And by the time they got out, they realized it was perfect. Perfect advice for them. And the thing is, you know, he was considered really wise, could see people, and so everybody, no one was supposed to say the advice they got. So that's why I kind of had, you know, mysterious. But it turned out he always had the same thing to everyone. All he said was, "What are you avoiding?" You think of that. Would you go for 3 days? Hike 3 days into the mountains and have someone tell you, what are you avoiding? Probably for some people it took that many days and that many days out to take that question seriously and to spend that time looking and looking and asking that question, what am I avoiding? What am I avoiding? I think of mindfulness, a synonym I have for mindfulness practice is to be honest. In a sense, honesty is mindfulness out loud. But there's no mindfulness practice unless we're honest with ourselves. And so it's very important, if you really want to do mindfulness practice deeply, not to do it just to feel a little bit better. Not to do it only to kind of relax and take away stress or sleep better. Those are certainly worthwhile doing it for those purposes. But if you want to really do this, the Buddhist mindfulness, and taste the power of it, then you want to see it as a synonym of being honest. It's really honest with yourself. What's really going on here? What are you avoiding? What are you afraid of? And also, what do you most want? Some people are afraid to ask that question of themselves. What do you most want? What would be the most important thing for you? And one reason some people are afraid of that question or the answer is they might want to change what they're doing. Maybe the life you've chosen is not the maybe that's not the life that makes your heart sing. Maybe it's not really what you most want to do. So what happens if you sit with the truth of that and honest about it? Maybe you would recognize that if you're doing a life that's not what you most want to do because of security, because of social pressures, or because of ambition, if you're really honest about that and sit with that honesty, do you feel the separation? Do you feel the not being connected to yourself? And if you're not connected to yourself, which one is the real you? Which one is the, which one? And in my interpretation of that story, neither of you are the real one. How about that? Isn't that kind of radical? You're not real? if you live that divide. But what happens if you're honest about it and sit with it? What will you do? Does it take courage? Do you have courage? Does it take risk? Is the risk worth it? Can you listen more deeply? Can you be creative? Can you find what you most want? Can you find what you're most trying to avoid about yourself? Can you find what is most painful inside of you and hold it in kindness, hold it in love? One of the kind of instructions that are sometimes given in this kind of meditation, Buddhist meditation world, that's kind of a little bit like a variation of mindfulness, is to sit in the middle of your fire. Sit quietly and be still in the middle of your pain and be kind. Be still in the middle of where it hurts and just be kind. That's all. See what happens. Sit in the middle of your strength and be kind. Sit in the middle of your life and be still and be honest. What would your life look like if you were whole, if the different pieces all came together? So that's the purpose of Buddhist meditation, at least, one of the purposes. And someone evoked the idea of being awakened, we awaken to who we are. To really become ourselves. And the paradox is that if we're no longer divided, be really truthful and be present in this full way and still way, that we realize that one of the ways we are divided from ourselves, separate from ourselves, is by being conceited. Isn't that something? We think, we most think we're, this is me. Boy, am I me. Boy, am I ever here. Being caught up in two strong ideas of self, two strong ideas of me, myself, and mine, is paradoxically a way to separate from yourself. And a way to reconnect involves a certain kind of dropping of conceit, a certain kind of dropping of strong referential concern. And so the excessive interest in becoming whole, I'm going to become whole, I'm going to heal all this division, if it's too strong or too conceited, that effort, I'm going to be the most non-conceited person on the block. It actually exasperates the division. So this is partly why the idea of sit still in the middle of it. Be quiet and still and be honest. Because then there's not the movement of conceit in that stillness. And then things begin to line up, things begin to come together, things begin to reveal themselves. It's a wonderful process. And I like to think of this process as a process of maturation, becoming spiritually mature. Sometimes lately I kind of prefer that to the idea of becoming liberated or enlightened or these kind of very idealistic kind of vague ideas. To me, the idea of becoming mature, spiritually mature or humanly mature, just it seems like it has a lot more heart in it, and a lot more flesh in this whole enterprise. So I hope these little words of today in the story are nice for you. I'm actually in the middle of teaching a 2-week meditation retreat. And somehow the experience, it's so deep, the experience people have, so connected. And this healing process that happens there is so powerful that, that's mostly what's on my mind. So I thought I would try to share a little bit of that with you as I'm being a witness of people at the retreat doing this work of coming together and meeting themselves, sometimes meeting themselves for the first time. After a long time. So we have about 10 minutes or so, and if you have any questions or comments about anything, you're welcome to ask a question or comment. Or
I haven't had a comment.
Yes.
Something that Matthew Brensilver said at one of the retreats is he was quoting somebody else, but he said, "Meditation, come for the peace, stay for the war."
On that note, could you say a little bit more about the difference between mindfulness and concentration?
If you take a snow globe and shake it and then hold it still, all the snow settles to the bottom. And then the globe is clear, and you can see clearly what's there. Concentration is a settling of the snow. And mindfulness is the clarity to see what's there. So we do concentration in order to quiet the mind enough, stabilize the mind enough, so that the work of the mind's eye can see clearly what's actually here, what's going on. Does that make sense?
So concentration is the effort or the skill of the work, as it were, of meditation, whereas mindfulness is the attitude or the...
Well, the two can be done as separate meditation practices. Some people only do practices that still, calm, settle the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be quite nice. Some people only do mindfulness where they're using the ability for the mind's eye, our knowledge, our awareness, our mindfulness, to see what's going on here, to really see clearly what's happening. But ideally they work together, because it's hard to see clearly if there's a lot of snow in the globe. right? Because it's all cloudy or something. And so it's good to settle because then it becomes clear. Or it's like mindfulness is like having a telescope that where you're looking at the moon, but if you're holding it in your hands, it's wobbly. Concentration is putting the telescope on a tripod. So we put our mindfulness on the tripod of concentration. And then it's stable, and it doesn't wobble, doesn't shake, and we can see much more penetratingly.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's have someone appears or hasn't spoken yet. Yes.
So concentration is let go of the thoughts. There's no flake. And then you can see clear.
So a little bit louder. Concentration is letting go of thoughts.
Oh, the thoughts that are coming down all the time on you. And then when you, okay, this is my time. I'm going to let go of everything so I can see clear who I am. Be something like this.
So I didn't quite understand. So concentration is having all the thoughts settle down, and then mindfulness is seeing who you are?
Yeah.
That's a good one. Someone else? Yeah, straight back.
I'd like to get your thoughts on this relationship between becoming a whole self and disidentification. So say, for example, I'm moved by a desire. And this desire could be for something, for goodwill, a status, just desire. And let's accept that it's a good desire. I'm going to try to do something good in the world.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes the path isn't so clear cut. You have many choices to make in order to pursue this desire. A lot of these choices are on par. They're not necessarily better or worse, they're on par. So then one might be paralyzed by all these different choices, but they have this burning desire to do good in the world. So, reflecting on this desire, perhaps, through mindfulness practice, you might be able to understand what it is, in fact, that's moving you, and perhaps is causing you the stress when you see all these choices proliferate before you. But isn't the act of observing that desire also an act of disidentification with that desire? So isn't there this separation of that desire that really defines you and also this observation of that desire? So where does the self come in?
So where was last, what's the last thing you said?
Where does the whole self come in, I guess, then?
Yeah, so disidentification. There is ways in which we, if I understand the word identification here, I think we have to define it, is some people will define themselves by desire, by certain thoughts, by roles, by all kinds of things we define ourselves by. But often when we define ourselves by it, people also get attached to that definition. So if I have a desire to do good in the world, if I identify that desire, now I am the world savior. You're probably going to get in trouble with such delusions of grandeur. Like I'm the one who's going to be the, I'm the great one. I'm the good one. It's not necessary to have that. It's not necessary to define oneself any way at all in pursuing a healthy desire. It's just I have a desire. I don't have to be the one who desires. So the disidentification, so as soon as I identify I'm the one who has this great desire, that's the separation. Because it's not really real. It's like here's the analogy I like for this identification thing, is you hike down to the river and you take a bucket and you sweep up a bucket full of water. And then you go walking back to the village and you say, look, here's the river. So, you know, we sweep up, I'm the world savior. I'm the one who has desire. I'm the one who's, you know, worked for the charities or something. And what you've done is you've scooped up some part of the stream of life and said, this is who I am. And that happened to me when, and that's a similar thing, when I was in college for a short while I decided to be an art major, and that was all fine. I enjoyed that a lot. And then the special day came where I decided I was an artist. And that was the last day I did art. Because somehow then I could feel my motivation was to be an artist because of the identity. So then I became separated from that part of me, the creative part, and it kind of locked it up. So at least in the Buddhist language, identification, defining ourselves by things, that's what creates separation. So if we can step back and be mindful enough to see how we've identified, how we've been caught by that desire, we realize that's extra. It's possible to have a healthy desire without then using it to define who we are. Does that answer your question, you think? More or less? Good luck. So thank you all for coming and sitting here today. I hope it was nice. And it was nice for me to come here from the retreat. It was kind of like, I don't know, sweet for me. So may you be whole. Or at least look at what you're avoiding. Thank you.